Before we start the show, I want to let you know that we will be taking a break next week for the holidays. We will return the following week on January the 2nd with the Washington Post Elon Mui. Now on to Macro Musings. Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Today is a special episode of Macro Musings where we look at the economics of Christmas. To help us do that, we have two special guests who join us all the way from Germany. Our first guest is Anna Godecka. Anna is a professor of economics and quantitative methods at the ESB Business School in Reutlingen, Germany. Our second guest is Laura Berg. Laura is a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for European Governance and Economic Development Research, University of Göttingen. Together, they authored a wonderful article in Economic Inquiry titled Christmas Economics, a Sleigh Ride, that surveys and summarizes economic literature on Christmas. Anna and Laura joins us today to discuss their article. Anna and Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we're glad to have you on, and we look forward to this conversation on Christmas economics, both the macro and micro side. Now, let's begin by asking, how did you get into economics? Let's start with you, Anna.
Oh, that's a tough question to start with. I guess my background is my family. They are all science teachers. And the only thing I knew was I don't want to do science and I don't want to become a teacher. And my idea was kind of doing something like economics or business. And the way to university here in Germany seems to be different than in the United States. So even as an undergraduate, you do not apply at university. You directly apply to a special study program. So even basically on the last day of high school, you need to decide what you want to do. And I just simply didn't know what to do. And there were just very, very few universities where you could choose as an undergrad business and economics. Mm-hmm. And that's why I actually moved to Bochum, a city in the middle of Germany, and to study business and economics as an undergrad. Yet, and then kind of during your time there, you could actually decide whether you would like to become more a business type person or more the economist. And you might guess I found out I didn't really like business too much. And then I found out I didn't like macro too much. So I ended up becoming a microeconomist.
Oh, very interesting. How about you, Laura? What is your story?
Well, in my family, one part is physicians and the other part are teachers. Mm-hmm. And somehow I tend to combine that, although I'm an economist, because I also work in health economics and, well, I also teach. But my story is similar to Anna's. When I had to decide for a field of study, I wasn't so sure what exactly to do. And I liked the discussion of current political and current economic events in school. What we surprisingly did most in English class and history class and less on like social science classes. And I thought that maybe political science, but also economics could be interesting. And well, there were limited options to combine those both fields. And then I ended up, starting to study economics and business administration, this combination in Bochum, and social science on the other hand. And then similar as for Anna, it turned out that I didn't like business as much, but also I found that economics was more interesting than this social science part.
Okay. Now, this article that both of you co-authored and written is really interesting. It's a nice survey. There's a lot of literature in the article that you survey about Christmas economics, so I know it took some serious work to get it done. And I'm wondering, how did you guys get on this topic? How did you come together, and then how did you decide to write this article on Christmas economics?
Well, actually, it started with a seminar of mine. When starting to teach in Göttingen, I first taught a master's seminar, and then I had to teach one for bachelor students. And I thought, what would be an interesting topic that, well, all the students can relate to, even those in the second or third semester, something where they don't need much prior knowledge. And actually, I asked my brother what would be an appropriate topic. And he said, so when is the seminar? And I said, in the winter term. So maybe November or December. And he said, so why don't you do a seminar on Christmas? And then I started to look for the literature. And I found that there's actually lots of literature on Christmas-related topics in economics. So there was some on health economics. There was some on prices. During Christmas time, there was, of course, the literature on the welfare effects of Christmas presents.
Mm-hmm.
There was enough for 14 topics in the seminar.
Yeah. So we can thank your brother for this nice article, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would kind of say Laura and I, we met during our undergrads already. And we never actually co-authored any other papers. So we knew each other for quite a long time, but we were more friends than actually co-authors. And we used to have a strange hobby, kind of. We teach in a summer school for gifted children during the summertime. And actually, that's how I came into that story. It was kind of the next summer after Laura taught the seminar. And we spent our summer in this summer school teaching a micro class. And she told me about this research. And it was just hilarious. It was warm outside. It was middle of the summer. And we were talking about Christmas. And I guess it was that summer that we decided we should do something with that topic. And then the next summer, we actually then wrote the paper.
Oh, very nice story. So let's jump into your paper. And let's begin with the macro side of Christmas. And of course, as we've talked about before the show started, all macro is really micro, if you want to get down to it. But we're going to pretend, at least for a few minutes here, that we're looking at the macroeconomic side of Christmas. And let's begin with what I think some really fascinating work done by Robert Barsky and Jeffrey Miron, and there's others as well, but they kind of started this literature, and that is on the seasonal business cycle. Everyone knows at Christmas time, sales picks up, you know, spending picks up. So tell us about that. What do they find, and what are the implications?
Well, I think most of us know is from, well, December, that the shops are crowded, the shopping streets or shopping centers are full of people. We all have these Christmas-specific transactions, buying presents, buying stuff for Christmas celebrations, maybe buying a Christmas sweater. And well, it's interesting to see that this, well, individual experiences actually becomes apparent in macroeconomic time series. And so what this literature does is to show that, well, contrary to the standard practice before to abstract from any seasonal variation, that to show that actually that there's a connection between the seasonal cycle and the business cycle, and to show that they may also have the same underlying mechanism. Well, just to have a few stylized facts, it's that literature that shows that actually having a seasonal dummy may explain very much of the variation. For example, 70% of the variation in GDP growth.
Yeah, that's what's striking about this. So the original article from Robert Barsky and Jeffrey Miron was in the Journal of Political Economy in 1989. And they look at the period 1948 to 1985, if I'm correct. I was looking at their paper a while back. And it's striking that most of the variation in aggregate economic activity, or GDP, comes from seasonality. That seasonality is this biggest kind of, it's like an exogenous shock that's regularly occurs. It comes from outside the system. Every preferences change into the year, and suddenly you have this change in behavior. And it's interesting. They measured it several different ways, and they got this huge amount of variation being explained by this.
and it's mostly Christmas. That's, I guess, the additional thing. It's kind of, you have the big seasonality. It's basically Christmas. You have actually a strong growth from the third to the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. And then, in the first quarter, you see much lower numbers. And what I like kind of that you have seen it in many different countries. And it seems that even if those countries don't celebrate Christmas, in other countries, you have another gift-giving holiday in the fourth quarter, so that you can see those effects in several countries over the world.
Oh, that's interesting. So even if they're not necessarily a Christian nation or Christian heritage, they still have this Christmas or this shopping spree that goes on in the fourth quarter. So,
yeah. The other thing was in summer, actually, you can see for Northern European countries, we tend to go on holidays or on vacation more often than other countries do, that you can also see a seasonality in summer, at least in Europe.
Fascinating. And the thing is, it's this fourth quarter spike is huge. I mean, he mentioned, and they mentioned in the papers, that the increase is significant. I forget, it was like 5% or 6%. It's much larger than typical. And the downturn is in January. So in January, the first quarter, there's a real sharp contraction. And the boom bust cycle, the last quarter of the year and the first quarter of the year, is often larger than many of the business cycles that occur. Now, of course, the Great Recession is an exception. That was an unusually large one. But if it's understandable, if you go through most of the time series, and at least with the U.S. history, that you see these seasonality effects. And I was just tinkering around with the data. I went and looked at some of the data. And unfortunately, the Bureau of Economic Analysis in the U.S. quit producing the non-seasonally adjusted GDP. But I learned in my search that they will be releasing it again in the future. But you can look at other things. I looked at retail sales, and you see the seasonal effects are huge. I mean, they're very large. And if you just look at a 10-year period, you can see that the recession is typically the business cycle. We take out the seasonality, look at the business cycle part of that, and those swings often aren't as big as the seasonal spikes, which, again, what's really fascinating as a macro guy is that we just take that out. We just assume it away, right? We de-seasonalize our data, we look at it, we run our vector auto regressions, do our shocks to look at the business cycle component, and we're missing an important part of the story, I guess. That's, we're leaving out useful information.
And I guess that's basically what the research shows, that you should look at the seasonality, and especially at Christmas.
Yeah, and now I know there's we need to be careful. I mean, I guess one difference between, this boom bust cycle that occurs every year and a big recession like the Great Recession is it's predictable, it's expected, right? So people there's some level of planning as opposed to a sudden shock like a Great Recession, which people weren't planning on. But even as I dug into these articles preparing for the show, even though we know it's coming, it's fascinating. They mentioned several observations related to this fact that the you would think, for example, like inventories would build up leading to this, but you don't see a proportional rise in inventories. That you actually see not only do you see a spike in sales, but you see a spike in production itself. I mean, it's truly.
But is it really that surprising? I mean, wouldn't we expect consumers to purchase the Christmas presents in November, December? We wouldn't expect consumers to build up inventories. And maybe with respect to the industry, maybe some of the Christmas presents also follow some trends and some current fashion. So
maybe there's not
the time to build up inventories.
So that's a good point. So you can't produce ahead of time the latest hit Christmas gift. So that's a fair point.
Some things maybe, yeah. Christmas ornaments probably don't change that much.
Yeah, I was just surprised.
I know a lot of people who are actually surprised by Christmas each year, so I might be guilty on that fact. I still don't have any Christmas presents at all.
Fair point. yes, personal.
So it is an exogenous shock to you.
It is. It's fair. It's a fair point. Many personal finance people will say, budget for Christmas. Many people do not budget for Christmas. But I guess what's also fascinating, if you want to take from the perspective of what explains business cycles, is different theories, right? There's real business cycle theory. There's kind of demand side driven Keynesian or monetarist theories. And this one here, it's truly exogenous, but it's this pickup in demand that's accommodated by the increase in production. And I guess what's also fascinating about it, so you have this increase in spending, and you know, Barsky and Myron, they show that prices remain relatively sticky. You don't see you see more change in quantities than you see in prices, right? So again, kind of a microcosm of business cycle debates we're having, in the sense that you have this big demand, exogenous demand shock. Prices are sticky, so real GDP picks up in that fourth quarter. It's kind of like a little, I think it was like a little laboratory. And the other fascinating thing they point out is that, well, several other things, labor productivity also goes up in the fourth quarter. So they keep the same amount, relatively same number of folks, and then there's this productivity picks up, and there's some additional hiring as well. But that was fascinating. And finally, they mentioned like money. You know, money. There's a seasonality component to money as well that occurs. So there's a whole area there, and I know there's been some other work done, but it seems to me kind of an under researched area. There seems to be a lot of interesting work. Now, you do mention in your article some other articles. You mention Wen Yi Wen, and he had an article you cited, The Business Cycle Effects of Christmas, and this was the more recent one. This is in 2001 in the Journal of Monetary Economics. And you know, he goes and he tries to make the connection between these seasonal effects and the business cycle. Anything interesting there you want to speak to?
I guess it's kind of a bit more in the first Myron papers. It was more you have a correlation. So it was already in the first papers that they say, okay, there seems to be at least a correlation between business cycles and seasonal cycles. So those countries who have strong seasonal cycles also have strong business cycles, but that was more correlation thing rather than having a real explanation for it. So they only refer to a correlation, and they say there might be the same propagation mechanism for both types of cycles. And the more recent Wen paper actually tries to actually find some more statistical reasons or better proofs that you actually see that. And it's not too different from the older Myron papers. He actually found that the seasonal shocks explain approximately 50% of the business cycles. So it's actually a strong finding based on better econometrics, basically.
Well, that's great. And again, once the BEA starts publishing this data, it'd be nice to see maybe some more research done on that. I found another short little piece by Yi Wen. He's out now at the St. Louis Federal Reserve, and I'll just mention this in passing. He looked at this idea that there was this great moderation in macroeconomic activity. So from at least in the U.S. from mid-1980s up until 2007, right before the Great Recession, you see volatility in GDP and these macro measures tend to stabilize. We call this a great moderation period. And he says we're looking just at seasonally adjusted data. What happens if you look at non-seasonally adjusted data? What happens to the great moderation then? And it's interesting that you see a similar moderating effect on the seasonal spikes. They're still there. They're still relative to the overall level. They're still important. They still explain a lot, but everything moderates. You know, the trend growth moderates as well as the seasonal part moderates as well. He takes that to mean that there was, because people try to come up with an explanation. Why did we get the great moderation? Was it better monetary policy? Were we just lucky? Was there some kind of structural change through technology, just-in-time inventories? And he thinks that because the seasonal effects are also smaller, there's got to be some kind of structural change that occurred during that period. So a very fascinating discussion there on the seasonal business cycle and the link. And I think there's a lot we can learn from that and a lot to still be done. You also mentioned in your paper about there's a relationship between the length of the shopping season and the strength of that fourth quarter effect. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So I guess that's a very much an American thing. To be honest, we do celebrate something that's Thanksgiving or a harvest festival. I think you have it in several Christian countries, but by far not to the extent you have in the United States. And in our case, we celebrate in October already. And we do not have this idea here of having a dedicated shopping season, which seems to be in the United States between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And the, as far as I understand, or my understanding of what I read, is that even in the United States, Thanksgiving has not always been celebrated on the fourth Thursday in November. So beforehand, it was always the last Thursday in November. But actually, it was Roosevelt who decided that you should have it a bit earlier, just to have a longer Christmas shopping season. And then he kind of switched it to the fourth Thursday in November, not the last anymore. Then you have your Black Friday. I still don't really know why Americans call it Black Friday, but you don't see something like that here in Europe. And then you seem to buy all your Christmas presents in a very, very short time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And the question for economists is basically, does that have an influence? So whether you have more or less days, do you actually spend a fixed amount of money, maybe more tinily over a given longer period, or do you actually increase consumption just because you have more days to spend your money? And the interesting finding, at least for me, was that even each day you have more between Thanksgiving and Christmas actually does increase the sales. So the retail sales increase the effect is quite strong. It's actually, they find that it's about 0.07% per day, which is not, it's highly significant, and it's actually quite a lot. There was another study coming up with the figure that for each additional day, I think it was $6.5 spent more per day, more between Thanksgiving and Christmas, which is kind of considerable.
Yeah, so it's fascinating, and it kind of speaks back to this kind of this preference, this exogenous change in behavior, a preference shock. And depending on when the holiday was set, you open up that preference shock earlier, you trigger it earlier. I guess it makes kind of for nice, almost like a natural experiment, right? You can see based on the different days when it actually falls. So that was really neat to read about that. And, you know, along those lines, you mentioned also a paper by, I guess, it's Mulligan, 2011, and he found that, you know, whether we're in a recession or not, you still have these seasonal effects, which again speaks to the strength of this exogenous preference shock or change to increase shopping. Very interesting.
And even employment. So they don't only find it for more sales. You also see higher employment even on an aggregate level. So it's not that it's just retail employees. Number increase, it's actually a large one, and you also can see it in January. So it has a huge effect.
Yes.
Again, and it actually does seem that people spend more, just to pick up that question meant earlier, whether they, people spend the same fixed amount over a longer time period, or if they just spend more, because this other paper Anna mentioned from Basker shows that people indeed spend more, which might then imply that they spend less in January, which does not seem to be the case, in fact. But or if they then just reduce their savings.
Yeah. So again, I think these are great findings, great things to know about when we're thinking about broader business cycle discussions. You know, what happens if there's demand side shocks or supply side shocks to the economy? Now, you also bring out something I have to throw in there, and this is kind of maybe half serious, but the way I'm going to frame it, it's a serious finding, but my question is going to be kind of joking. But you also find, or the literature finds, that there's increased alcohol consumption during the Christmas season, right? So people pick up their drinking, and I'm just wondering, again, this is where I'm getting a little less serious. You think there's any link between the lubricating the social spirits through alcohol during the Christmas season and the pickup in optimism and spending during the holidays?
Well, maybe it's just here, sure.
Yeah.
Sorry, Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay, so I don't know whether you've ever been in Europe before Christmas. My understanding is, or at least I haven't seen it in the United States to the extent we have it here, but we have all these Christmas markets all around. So each normal city has a little Christmas market with all the stalls where you can sell, or can actually they try to sell you some Christmas ornaments and some Christmas cookies. But one very, very important part is basically, it's cold here, it's dark, you need to get warm. So you drink a lot of mulled wine, you drink this Christmas punch. So I don't know if you go to any German city after 5 or 6 o'clock before Christmas, you see people being drunk just because of these Christmas markets. And maybe the important bit is all that research, I guess, more or less came from Europe. I think there were some papers from Australia as well. But they have those findings in Finland to a very large extent that people drink socially much, much more before Christmas. And then, unfortunately, even more people die because of intoxication before and at Christmas, which is maybe not the too optimistic part of Christmas. But yeah, it seems to be a rather social event, and maybe good for Finland or maybe bad for Finland. They have another big celebration in summer. They celebrate Midsummer Day. They even find a lot of more people dying of alcohol consumption on that day, too. So it's basically in summer and at Christmas, you basically die because you're getting drunk.
Well, coming back to this paper on the variation in the length of the shopping season, this actually finds that people tend to spend less money on liquor in January. So maybe it's that, well, peak in consumption in December that induces them to reduce alcohol consumption in January again, or maybe it's just New Year's resolutions, which may also be linked to the increase in consumption around Christmas.
So they're sobering up and trying to get their act together after living large. But yeah, so it's there's both tragedy and interesting things. And the tragedy is there's a lot more death from alcohol consumption during this time. But you know, again, going back to some macro theories, does this drinking bring out the animal spirits? People start because again, the kind of the point from this the business seasonal effect on the business cycle. It's people, there's like this exogenous demand spending shock that occurs, and I may be reaching here, but to what extent does the increased alcohol consumption kind of, you know, make that, facilitate that, or maybe it would happen in any event.
It would be nice to have a study whether you actually spend more when you're drunk, but I don't know of any. So maybe that would be something you should look into, the willingness to buy something higher the more alcohol you drank before. I don't know.
I imagine the
stylized facts confirm this.
We'll have to find some kind of natural experiment to do that, because I imagine the review boards at different places would have a hard time. But that'd be a fun one to see what happens. You also have something in your paper. You review some articles about increased deaths during the Christmas season. Now, we mentioned the alcohol-related ones, but in general, are there more deaths in that fourth quarter of the year?
It depends a bit on what kind of death you consider.
Okay.
So, and generally, there's also always the common belief that the dark times of Christmas, of, well, maybe some people being lonely, others having to meet family members too often, leads to more suicides. But in fact, the literature shows that there's not an increase in suicides, but there are in fact less suicides before Christmas.
So suicides go down then?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they go up at New Year's Day.
Okay.
So less suicides. So maybe you spend too much time with your family and then you commit suicide on New Year's Day. But yeah, at Christmas going down in several countries, it seems to be a rather strong fact, but it's increasing in New Year.
So it goes down Christmas time, but right before the New Year,
Well, actually, it's New Year's Day. New Year's Eve's the low. New Year's Day, it's going up again.
Okay. I was wondering if there's any kind of tax benefits or any kind of tax incentives going on here. Not to be too yet to be some sick relative decides to do so. Okay, we'll ignore that question. What about conception during Christmas season? It seems to be, according to your survey, a spike in the number of children conceived during this time. Is that right?
Yeah. What the literature finds is that there's actually a high number of conceptions occurring in December, which then implies that there's a peak in the number of births in September and the following year. This has been found for several countries, so maybe it's not that much related to dark times, but rather to leisure times. because there's in fact also a similar effect for August vacation. And there's another peak in conceptions in August and a peak in birth in May then. But I don't think it's that much about planning more children. It's rather about having more sex, because there's also an increase in the sales of condoms in December and an increase in the termination of unwanted pregnancies around December.
And you think it's tied more to there's more leisure time around? It's not necessarily related to Christmas per se, just people have more leisure, more time on their hands?
Yeah, maybe not right before Christmas, so it's probably a stressful time for most of us, but maybe around Christmas and the days after.
Okay. Yeah. After they've been drinking for a few days, they been lubricated, and they start conceiving children. Now, this is, of course, maybe a good thing, right, for the Western economies, Europe, the U.S. We need, you know, our labor supplies to grow. We need support our welfare states that are being underfunded in the long run. So we should be happy for this holiday conception shock, we'll call it that. Okay, let's move on to another fascinating area here, and this is where you guys can shine as microeconomists. You've already shined as microeconomists, but this is really getting into the microeconomic literature debate, and this is the deadweight loss of Christmas. So there's a huge literature on this, and this, I think, for many people, this will actually come close to home, because we've all had this angst about getting gifts and exchanging gifts on Christmas, not getting what we want or giving the wrong gift. So tell us about the deadweight loss literature, what it tells us.
So maybe you can start. What was the worst Christmas gift you ever got?
Well, I don't want to get in trouble in case someone's listening, but I'll generalize here. How about this? We all get the certain, you know, we get a shirt from someone that's really ugly looking, and or we get, you know, something we don't really need. We get another tie. I'm sure you probably have a probably better story than I do. So why don't you take a swing at that?
Okay, so maybe just to give you the general idea, as you said, we all know these Christmas presents we got and we just never used. We just throw it away the next day. And it was actually Waldvogel. It was already in 1993. That he started to think about Christmas, and he said, well, maybe we have a problem here as economists. So normally if you buy something, let's say you buy your Christmas sweater or something like that, you just buy it if your willingness to pay is actually higher than the price. So you would not buy anything where your valuation for the good is actually lower than the price. And that's what we as economists or microeconomists call the consumer surplus. So the difference between the price and your willingness to pay. And that's fine if you decide to buy the Christmas sweater yourself. But if your granny gives you the Christmas sweater, the problem might be that the price was actually much higher than what you would be willing to pay for that Christmas sweater. And that's where the problem comes in, because you don't generate consumer surplus here, but you actually waste economic resources. And in the first paper from Waldvogel, what he actually did, he asked his students about their Christmas presents, and he asked them basically for two things. The first was the willingness to pay, so basically asking them how much would you have been willing to pay for your Christmas presents, which seems to be a lower bound for the valuation. And the other question was asking them what is your willingness to accept, so how much would we now have to pay you so that you give us the Christmas sweater from your grandmother. And it was a bit disappointing that he found on average that the valuation for the gifts was actually 30% lower than the price. So we would actually say that's really, really bad for welfare. And talking about the gift givers, it seems, for example, that grandparents are really not the best ones. So grandparents, uncles, aunts are not the best gift givers, so they generate the highest welfare loss. Friends and partners seems to be much better in finding appropriate Christmas presents. And the very pragmatic solution of an economist would be just give cash. Because when you give them cash, it's maybe very impolite, but nevertheless, you can just buy what you want to buy. And it seems that people understand kind of whether they are good gift givers or bad gift givers, because grandparents seem to give more cash because they kind of understand they don't really know what to give. And therefore, their share of cash presence actually much higher than for other gift givers. And as you said, it's a huge bunch of literature. So that was the first paper, and you have several other papers by Walt Vogel actually doing similar things. And he always found more or less welfare losses. There were other papers who focused more on the willingness to accept. They found welfare gains. So the crucial part seems to be actually to understand what is actually the valuation for the gift you got. And in some studies, you find a welfare loss, and some you do actually find a welfare gain.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the tension is, and this is, you know, for example, I will disclose my mom, you know, likes to say, hey, but if I give cash, I didn't put any heart into it. I didn't, you know, doesn't mean as much, isn't as thoughtful. I didn't go around and shop all day looking for a gift for you. And but the flip side of that is you get something you don't want and you have this deadweight loss. The world would have been a better place. Now, let me ask this question. There are some gifts, though, you probably don't want to do in cash. So if we all agree that, okay, let's exchange cash, right? There are some things, for example, if I had proposed to my wife and gave her a bunch of cash instead of a ring, I don't know if that would have gone over well. What do you think?
Yeah, or if you want to give a Christmas present to your boss and you just give him cash. It's
yeah.
Just weird. There are just some social things, but I must admit, in some cases, some presents I got, I don't know whether a very strange gift or cash, what would have been worse. So sometimes the question is, what's even worse, giving cash, giving a gift, or giving nothing?
Yeah. So what advice do you give to all our listeners, and how would you summarize the literature? What would you tell them to do, under what circumstances should they do, like cash or gift cards versus actual gifts?
There's one paper from Flynn and Adams, which I like quite a lot, that what they found is that most of us are gift givers and gift receivers, although we seem not to be very, very good in actually estimating how important actually the price of a gift is. So their suggestion is just give smaller gifts, because we overestimate actually the prices of the gift. So your mother will be maybe as happy with a smaller gift or less expensive gift than with a more expensive gift, and furthermore, you won't create such a big welfare loss. So just focus on smaller ones, and just think about how good do you know the person, and it might be your boss, and you have to come up with a Christmas present. Then just stick to the normal things. So just a bottle of wine or a box of chocolate, just the more standard ones that might be a good idea. Or our suggestion is just come back to wish lists. Even if we used to do that just as kids, writing a wish list what we want to have, it might be a good idea within a family to actually have such a wish list, and then don't create a welfare loss.
Very interesting.
Well, there's another paper that says that gift giving can be optimal if it reduces search costs. And so maybe in some cases, gift giving can be optimal if you make some presents where, well, maybe some people don't want to search for themselves, or maybe even of some things they don't even know yet. If I know that someone likes reading a specific type of novels, and I know a novel, then maybe that person likes being introduced to that novel because he or she didn't know it before. And if I think of some of the presents my parents gave me when I was a kid, I think it was very much related to reducing the search cost for these specific things, not for me, but for like going shopping with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think buying socks for me is easier than buying socks when I'm around.
Okay. So have you guys incorporated this into your own gift giving, your own Christmas experience? Do you practice what you preach?
As I told you, I don't have any Christmas presents yet. So my nephews will get some Christmas presents. That is kind of easy. They are kids. They like it. What is more difficult for me is actually I try to convince people not to give presents to me. I wasn't always successful with that, but sometimes I'm just thinking, please don't give me cash. Don't give me any presents. I'm happy just to be around with you, but just forget about them.
Yes.
I've asked people for wish lists, but unfortunately, I haven't provided a wish list for myself so far.
Yes. Well. Speaking of charitable giving and gift giving, let's segue into something else that's interesting. And what happens to charitable giving during the holiday season? Do you have some articles you cite on that?
This also seems to increase before Christmas. So it seems to be that people are more generous before Christmas. This one paper who analyzed that for church donations, and well, they actually had a different focus. They had a focus on the crowding out effect of first mm-hmm. and second donations. But they find that in general, church donations are higher around Christmas, when also maybe attendance in church is higher. And also the literature on tipping finds that tipping is or that higher tips are given before Christmas.
Yeah, this, you know, you've heard the of the CE Christians, right? The Christians who only go to church on Christmas and Easter. This is true. And I know there's been work done. I've seen some kind of religious studies, sociology type work looking at seasonal trends in church attendance. Yeah, I was aware of that. But the charitable giving one's also fascinating because, at least in the U.S., there's a tax incentive to give in December. If you do charitable giving, you know, by the end of the year, you get to write it off the next year, or you deduct it the next year. And I will confess, I have been guilty of maximizing. You know, if I have something to give, I'll make sure to give it before the deadline crosses. You know, I make sure to make that extra donation at my church or whatever it may be, just because I know there's a tax benefit. So I'm having a confession here of sorts, but I wonder to what extent if that's been looked at. Do people look at is the increase in charitable giving truly from the heart, or is it in part driven by, you know, tax incentives?
I'm not sure. I must admit I haven't seen a study looking at that. So I don't know, and it seems again to be I haven't heard about this tax incentive here in Europe, so okay. It doesn't matter when you give throughout the year. So here you wouldn't have a tax incentive. So I haven't seen any study, but I must admit I haven't looked or tried to find one because I wasn't aware of this tax effect.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not sure. Do you put your donations in church on your tax declaration?
Absolutely.
You do?
Yeah, so in the U.S., you can actually, when you file your taxes, you can actually deduct charitable giving, and as long as you've got some kind of documentation, you know, like my church actually end of the year will tell how many offerings or tithes I've given and stuff, and then you can go do that. So it is maybe unique to America, and the more I think about this as I'm talking out louder, I think there have been some economists who have looked at this, but you know, on the margin, we always respond to incentives on the margin, and I'd like to believe I give because I really believe, but on the margin, I'm going to maximize my you know, utility by also responding to tax incentives. Well, let's go to something else, and let's look at traveling during the Christmas holidays. Does that change?
Yeah, it does. So what you see is airfares go up. It's actually, as a microeconomist, I say good, because that's what you would expect. So the supply is kind of the same. You do not have more airplanes or more slots at the airports. You have higher demand, so prices go up. That's kind of convincing. The other thing we've into is gas price, at least. Again, here, explain that before holidays, that doesn't need to be Christmas, but also Easter, gas prices would go up, but there are actually no studies that would confirm that. So we found studies for Canada, the United States, Australia. They could never find actually a significant increase in prices before Christmas and other holidays. So at least there seems no, there doesn't seem to be any indication for that yet. Maybe talking a bit about other prices. Sorry, I'm here, the microeconomist. So what is kind of interesting, or we found kind of interesting, that supermarket prices and consumer good prices actually fell before Christmas, which might be counterintuitive, because again, you would say you have a higher demand. Why should the prices go down? But on a microeconomic level, you can see that prices go up. And there have been different explanations for that, and one which sounds very reasonable to me, and you could actually show that with data, is that you have something like economics of scale in price search. So before the Christmas holidays, and probably even before Thanksgiving, if you do your groceries, you have an incentive to go to different jobs or even to drive a longer distance just because you buy more. So you become more price sensitive, and therefore supermarkets actually have an incentive to reduce the prices. That is one reason which you could find. Another reason, and I'm doing a lot of competition economics here, you see that normally or firms kind of tacitly collude throughout the year. And if you have an incentive to deviate from this tacit collusion, it's obviously during periods of high demand, and that's before Christmas. And that's another reason why prices might be lower before Christmas. And the last one, which might be interesting, is that you see that when you look actually at brand level demand, that people switch from branded products to non-branded products before Christmas or other holidays, basically because they have a limited amount of money and they are getting more price sensitive. And so they basically buy the cheaper brands or the non-branded products before Christmas. So on average, it seems that the prices seem to fall before Christmas.
Fascinating. Yeah, that is kind of counterintuitive at first, but these are interesting explanations you've given. And that reminds me of another point you guys make in your paper or literature you survey. And you mentioned this, and many of us probably can speak to this firsthand, personal experience, is that sometimes we have these hot toys, these popular gifts that sell out during Christmas, right? So why does that happen? Why is the market clearing through quantity, not through price? Why don't things just, I'm old enough to remember when I was a little kid, Cabbage Patch dolls. I remember later Tickle Me Elmos. Some other hot toys that just sell out really quick at Christmas time. What's the story behind that?
Well, you have actually what you call hot toys, where you actually have shortages and things like that. So there have been different explanations for that. And one seemed to be that even if a product is sold out, so you have these shortages, it's actually free publicity and free good publicity for you. So you have such a hot product, and it's actually sold out before Christmas, it might be just better for the period after Christmas that you sell more. And another one that is actually, I think from Kloneman, he mentioned that if you would actually increase the prices, so try to stop this shortage and just don't do the quantity thing, but just increase the prices, that would actually be very, very bad news. So the customers would actually be offended knowing, okay, now my doll costs much, much more before Christmas just because it's a hot toy. So that would be very, very bad publicity. So firms try to avoid that.
So there's some strategic thinking. I mean, it could be to avoid the bad press, as you just mentioned, but there also could be, I'm going to, really what they're doing is they're maximizing maybe profits over a longer horizon. If they create the buzz, yeah, sure, there's a shortage, but you know what? They're going to come back in January and June. They're going to come back throughout the year. Buy up the rest of those Tickle Me Elmos when they come back on stock. So as opposed to just a one-time fix, which as you mentioned, if you increase the price to clear the market, you might actually lose those sales in the future. All right, that's fascinating. So one thing I actually meant to mention earlier, we were talking about in the business cycle, the macro side, and that I see here on my list, and that is the stock market during the holiday season, the Christmas season. There's been this finding in the literature that there's been an abnormal return. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is a relative extensive and somewhat old literature already. This literature finds that stock returns are higher before Christmas, and like for the US, there's something like 20 to 23 times higher the days before Christmas as compared to the other trading days. This extensive literature has also studied this for other countries and finds that this is not just limited to the US, or it's used to be a common thing also for Japan, Canada, Australia, or Hong Kong.
And what's interesting, it's been persistent, right? It normally you think of these anomalies, like if there's excess return, then people are going to take advantage, arbitrage it away. They're going to try to make money off of that, but it's persistent. Is that right?
It's persistent, but it declines over time.
It has, okay.
Yeah.
So there's actually one study who actually focuses on this time trend of this pre-holiday effect, and that literature finds that it's that in the US and the UK it's decreasing over time, and that there's actually been a reversal at one time period in the US where there were actually lower returns before Christmas. And this paper explains this by the fact that market participants based their trading on this documentation of this effect, but in fact this effect is already gone, and so they try to exploit something which is no longer there, and by this they create a new thing and a reversal of this effect then.
Yeah, so it's the efficient market hypothesis kind of thinking is kicking in here, that at some point these opportunities will be arbitraged away, and they are being arbitraged away. Interesting. So we're running near the end of our program here. We've got a few minutes left. Kind of just some general questions, you know, stepping back from all this literature and stuff. Do we see any evidence that, you know, as some parts of like Western Europe, the U.S. to a lesser extent, they're becoming more secular. There's still a lot of religious, you know, activity and religious participation in the United States, and I'm sure in Europe as well. But do you think, or is there any evidence that would suggest that as, you know, as the advanced economies become more secular, there's going to be less Christmas activity?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I haven't seen anything, and at least my understanding is that the Christmas celebration, at least my impression here in Germany, is it is not to that extent a Christian celebration anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you might know that in East Germany the number of Christians is quite low, nevertheless they celebrate Christmas to a large extent.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether that actually, and as you said, you had this nice term for the ones only going to church on Christmas and Easter. So I'm not sure whether the economic background or the economic changes, or there will be any economic changes just because the people go to church less often or anything like that.
Okay. So it's become more of almost like a holiday that's celebrated despite, you know, what people think about religion. So on balance, do you think Christmas is good for the economy, and both from a short-run perspective and a long-run perspective? What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's hard to say. I wouldn't want to conclude here. Mm-hmm. So at least as a microeconomist, I would say the picture is mixed. You see some welfare loss. You might not see it to such an extent in other studies. I'm not sure about the macro side, honestly. If you have those seasonal effects, and nevertheless those seasonal effects are the same each year, does that really have a long-run implication? I'm just not sure. So if you would ask me whether we should still celebrate Christmas or not, I wouldn't want to judge that as an economist.
Well, one thing we know, we talked about earlier, we're definitely increasing the population, right? that's a positive.
Well, we had also more deaths. So.
That's true. Okay, fair point. we need those extra babies to pay for the cost down the road. So we're incurring.
That might
Christmas.
Not actually be a real increase. So it could just be a distributional thing.
Yes, intergenerational transfer of wealth.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you guys joining us today on the show. Our guests today have been Laura Berg and Anna Gutica. Laura and Anna, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.